Welcome everybody. Again, I'm so excited to learn with all of you. So this class I'm excited to work through with all of you because this is a subject that is a big stretch for me, and I assume might be a big stretch for all of us, which is to seriously and not with as little embarrassment as possible, consider the possibility that God's body can help our own experience of the divine. And I'm starting from a couple of places of my own personal assumptions, but I don't want to map that onto you unnecessarily. So do realize that this is some of the stuff that I'm struggling with, but you don't have to resonate with that if it doesn't apply to you. For my own struggles, I would say, first of all, that my relationship with God is uneven. That is to say, it's not a perfectly straight line that is always at the same level of experience or intensity, but it goes up and down. And therefore, I feel like I need some possibilities to, you know, sort of stack the deck for the upside and try to minimize the downside. That is to say, I'm both explaining that I feel this relationship as uneven, but also that there might be something that we could do about it. I'm saying that it's not a given that relationship has to be random or only sort of dependent on someone else, but that I might have some agency in working on this situation, this relationship. The other thing I want to draw upon is based on a midrash, also from Tanhuma that Rav Eitan quoted earlier, but a different part, which is that there is a possibility of deeper experience. And this one line from the midrash says, in talking about a verse that expresses how we should seek out God always, to seek out God's presence, or maybe literally God's face always, the midrash says, Pe'amim nir'eh, u'pe'amim eino nir'eh. Sometimes God is seen, and sometimes God isn't seen. Which I think opens up the possibility that although sometimes God isn't seen, nevertheless, sometimes God is seen. And the possibility that we might be able to draw closer because of that perhaps literally visual experience, but just to open up a window, it's not just God is hidden forever. But God is sometimes seen, or if you feel more comfortable at this stage, experienced. Okay? So number one, my relationship is uneven. Number two, we have some agency. I think that we have some agency on working on that unevenness. And number three, there is a possibility of going somewhere intense. Pe'amim nireh. Sometimes God is seen, or sometimes God is experienced. That's what I'm putting out there. And the last thing that I want to put out there is, and maybe even in some ways, headlining the entire thing in case you get zapped by lightning or space out, whatever might happen in this next hour, is the way in which we think about and relate to God is often not helped by philosophical, logical arguments, but is helped by real relationships. And when you think about the way that works with people, sometimes when you are forming a friendship or a romantic relationship or a connection or a network, it's not that somebody made an argument to you and then you said, yes, let's be friends, you've convinced me. There's actually something serendipitous about the relationship itself, and what is the dynamic between humans that draw close to each other, not because of arguments, but because of experiences that we might be able to draw upon and as we think about this in our relationship with God. So those are some of the conceptions and the framings that I want to put forward before we begin. And my hope is, really, this is, I say this honestly, it is a stretch for me, so I'm not saying that I have clear answers, but I'm trying to open this topic up wide-eyed, and I hope that we'll be able to engage in that exploration together. So here's the plan. We've got four parts to this class. My temptation is to stay in the safer parts of the class, which is when I overwhelm you with evidence that God has a body. And the reason that's the safe part, again, looking out, the reason that's the safe part is because the unsafe part is, what do we do with that possibility, and how might we actually play that out in our own relationship with God? That's what I want to drive to, okay? So the way it's going to be structured is, number one, God's body in the Bible. Number two, God's body in Chazal, the way the sages consider God's body. Number three, the rejection of the notion of God's body in some medieval sources. And then number four, which we must get to, our own connection to this issue and the way in which a couple of texts that I want to put out there, which if you read as taking seriously and not metaphorically God's body in those texts, might, this is the hypothesis, but really we are going to explore together, might affect our relationship with God, or might open up a different pathway to our relationship with God. Sound good? You ready? You can still go to Jason's class. They just started, okay? All right, we're in the packet in the yellow pages right after the table of contents. This is section one, which is God's body in the Bible. You'll see it labeled section one, God's body in the Bible. I'm just doing that mainly for you. Okay, the first book that I want to bring to your attention is a wonderful book written by Professor Benjamin Summer, called The Bodies of God and the World of Ancient Israel, which came out a few years ago, where he makes actually an even more radical argument than the one that I'm going to bring here, which is the non-radical argument is God has a body. His more radical argument is God has bodies and is actually can appear in different places in different discrete formations. I don't want to necessarily go down that route, although he brings a lot of evidence to say at least the Bible thought of it that way. But let's just start with the very first sentence of his book. The God of the Hebrew Bible has a body. I didn't notice any subordinate clauses there. He goes on to say, this must be stated at the outset because so many people, including many scholars, assume otherwise. The evidence for this simple thesis is overwhelming, so much so that asserting the carnal, that means body, nature of the biblical God should not occasion surprise. Okay, so just putting it out there, okay? The God of the Bible has a body. Give me an example. Etz Elohim, the finger of God. Finger is in that sentence. What else? Yeah? Outstretched arm. What else?
Walking.
Walking where? In the garden. Walking around in the garden. Where else? Panim el panim, face to face.
God's back.
God's back. If you can't see my front, I'm going to show you my back. Okay? Lot of God's body. Now, I have been trained to immediately jump to metaphors in all of those associations. Right? Oh, the finger of God. This must have been the hand of God. Like Adam Smith. Right? Doesn't he have the invisible hand? Okay? We've been socialized, people. Okay? But a hand can sometimes be a hand. Let's just see how some of this. This is one of my favorite texts that deals with this, from Shmot Kaf Dalet, Exodus 24. This is after the revelation and after Parshat Mishpatim, after the laws are given. Then Moses and Aaron and Nadav and Avihu and 70 elders of Israel ascended, vaya'al. Okay, they went up. And they, vayir'u et Elohe Yisrael, pause, comma. They saw the God of Israel. It is much easier to see the God of Israel when God has a physical manifestation. I'm explaining this to like our kids, you know? Try explaining God without a body to a child, okay? Oh, God is, what is God? Did Hashem make today sunny or hot? Yes, that one we got down. Now, where is Hashem? Everywhere. Oh, that's a little bit scary, okay? As opposed, like, where am I? Well, I'm right here. So that I can relate to. Like, I'm not here, I was in the kitchen, you didn't see me, that's why, because I was in another room. But God is everywhere. Well, why can't I see God? Because God's invisible. What's that? I'm three, okay? So you can see how this gets hard. But what if it was literally just, God has a body. You can't see it, because if you did, you'd be overwhelmed.
Lo yirani ha'adam v'chai. You may not see me and live. Doesn't mean you can't see me. It's not that it's impossible to see me. It's that if you do see me, you'll die. You know who has this experience? Isaiah. Also in the Bible. Look down on page 1. In the year that King Uzziah died, I beheld va'er'eh et Adonai. I saw God. I beheld my Lord. That sounds a little bit better because to behold, the eye of the beholder. No, I saw, ra'ah. I saw my God seated on a high and lofty throne, and the skirts of his robe filled the temple. By the way, much easier to wear a robe if you have a body. Seraphs stood in attendance on him. Each of them had 6 wings. With 2 he covered his face, with 2 he covered his legs, and with 2 he would fly. You know what's coming next? Turn over the page. And one would call to the other, V'kara ze el ze v'yamar, Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzevaot. Holy, holy, holy is Adonai, Yud-Heh Vav-Heh of hosts. His presence fills all the earth. Milo chol ha'aretz kavodo. God's everywhere. But I thought I just saw God. Okay. What is the kavod? We can go down this rabbit hole. But in the meantime, just to note, Isaiah sees God. And here's the angel saying, holy, holy, holy. Now, what is the reaction that Isaiah has upon reciting this verse? And tell me if this is our experience of reciting this thing, the Kedusha. The doorposts would shake at the sound of the one who called, and the house kept filling with smoke. I cried, oili, kinid meiti, woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my own eyes have, ra'u enai, have beheld, have seen the King, Adonai of hosts. So the concern of Isaiah here isn't, wait a minute, I remember singing Yigdal in Shul, and it says, Ein lo d'mut ha'guf, v'ein lo guf. He has no form of a body and has no body. And I just saw God's body, so my head just exploded. No, it's, I saw God. That doesn't seem to be the problem that you can, the God is seeable. The problem is, I have unclean lips, and I'm among people of unclean lips, and therefore I'm toast, right? But the issue at hand is not whether God can be seen. It's that it's just you can't survive the experience of seeing God. Now, sometimes this idea was played out in other biblical verses where the people who added the vowels to the Torah try to work this over for us. So, for instance, in text number 4 on page 2, 3 times a year, shalosh panimim bashana, how are you saying the next word? So here it's pronounced yeira'eh. Kol zechurcha el peneha adon Adonai. All your males shall appear, a passive verb, shall be seen before the sovereign, the Lord. But you could also easily read that as yireh, right? We'll see. Behar Adonai, Har HaMoriah, the mountain of Moriah, but means, where's my Chicago people? What does Moriah mean? Har HaMoriah. Yeah, to see, you're like ra'ah, right? Behar Adonai, what is it? Yeira'eh, God will be seen. Or maybe it's yireh, God will see, right? Mount Scopus, you got a good view, but God's got a better one, okay? Again, much easier to see with eyes. So you can see the way in which if you just work on the nikudot, they're just throwing this right by us here, okay? Behar Adonai yeira'eh, you wouldn't have even thought to say yeira'eh. Right? You're going to be seen 3 times a year as opposed to God sees you 3 times a year. Okay? So this is all the ways in which God's body appears in the Bible. And we don't have to run through each of these, but I hope that the thesis that's presented by Ben Sommer, where he just has to write it, he's an academic. And that was the clearest sentence I've ever read in an academic book. The God of the Hebrew Bible has a body. He just had to go really clear there because, as he said, people don't think it's true, even scholars, okay? This is section 1. Any comments, questions, reactions to the biblical understanding of God having a body? Thoughts, concerns? Yeah.
It's just that nothing written negates what you said you were and I was brought up with, which is metaphor. In other words, it's not so simple as Ben Sumner posits that it is a body versus some metaphor to an action.
Okay, good. Nothing here in the language, nothing here in the language would take it out of the possibility
that it, this is a metaphor. When Isaiah sees God, Isaiah experiences God and is afraid of the experience. When God was walking in the garden, it wasn't that God was literally walking, but we all know that walking a path can be a metaphor. So again, and by the way, we're not idiots. So you can read the Bible in the way that you're suggesting, meaning we can tell the difference between true and false. So if you're going to take this all as a metaphor, you can go down that road. And indeed, I would say most of Jewish life, not all of Jewish life, but most of Jewish life chose that path. But I don't think you have to. And I would say, Hamotzi mechavaro alav araya, the burden of proof might be on you if you want to say this is a metaphor when you're sort of having all these examples of the physical experience. Now, you don't have God literally reaching out and touching like the Sistine Chapel, like a human God contact. That would be, you know, sort of, that, then we're done. But you could also maybe say that's a metaphor. But yes. And if, by the way, if you leave here at 11:30 and you say, you know what, all this stuff with God's body, I actually prefer it as a metaphor and I'm going with that, you'll be in good company, perhaps in entirely unanimous company. But what I want to put on the table is, if our relationship with God needs some work, maybe the metaphor isn't working enough. And perhaps the body approach might help as opposed to go down ooky path. Because it can be ooky to think of God's body, but maybe it's actually helpful. That's why we've got to stick around to section four, and I think the jury's out. So I don't want to say that we're not coming back to your position, but that's at least what we're trying to test. Yeah.
So even at this early stage, are we kind of giving God a male body because of grammatical defaults, or is there more weight to those descriptors?
Okay, so now you're already... I've sold you that God has a body, maybe... Okay, but I'm but now I have some other problems that come up, which is, well, what's the gender of God's body, or what are the physical attributes of God's body? Is the fact that it's conjugated male, when Hebrew has to choose a conjugation, male or female, then does that indicate something about the nature of God's body? And maybe it's something in the list of the metaphors that Ethan read out in the introduction. You heard four metaphors. None of them was a nursing woman. And so maybe the metaphors are, maybe the images of God as a body are going to take me to a whole other gender question, which I also want to sort of put on the table. But I think that's the right next question, which is to say, once we have a body, now we have to talk about, well, what does the body look like? Okay, I'm curious to figure out. And we said, well, we apparently have legs, we've got a finger, we've got a hand. We can start to sort of like amalgamate the body parts of God, and does the conjugation or other context clues lead us to some specific vision of God's body? Okay, yeah, Ellie.
I think, sort of to pick up on the previous point, something that I'm struggling with right now is, like, there seems to be a fine line between reading these texts as metaphorical versus what I think you might be trying to do, and I'm not sure I can fully understand what that, meaning, like, unless you're saying, which I don't think you're saying, when Yeshayahu is describing his vision of God, he is actually seeing something physical in front of him. Unless you're saying that, what is...
I might be saying that. I might be saying that, okay. Yeshayahu saw something physical.
Okay. Okay, fine.
You're talking about body parts and perhaps senses, but what are the implications if you say God has a body? What are the processes inside his body? What is his,
oh, okay,
like?
Good. This is a related question to Ariel, which is, once you say that God has a body, then you have to start asking, well, what are the functions of God's body? How does God's brain work? What, you know, is it one-to-one correlation with our body in terms of the functioning of the body? Okay? Now again, these are reasonable questions. They are not answered in the Bible, but they are the questions that you start to ask when you are considering the simple fact that the Bible thinks that God has a body. Yeah.
Or could the two questions of God does or doesn't have a body be answered with the same answer of God took the form of a body in these situations because it was helpful to human beings?
Okay, good. So now you're asking a sort of a hedge question, which is maybe God has a body, but only in the way that God relates to humans. By the way, this is sort of an argument that Ben Sommer makes, which is you think an angel is a separate sort of lower level holy being, But he makes the argument that no, angels are actually confused with God often. I mean, think about the moment when the three angels visit Abraham in the heat of the day. And it seems like Abraham is addressing God. And then we're talking to angels and the angels speak. So that's one way in which you could say, well, God takes the body of a person. An angel is God in a person's body. What was that movie with George Burns? That
oh,
one.
God.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah, right. So,
You just dated yourself big time.
Anyways, that would be one way you could think about it, and that would, and then you could gather some evidence that in order to experience God's presence without overwhelming you, I have to be a small flame in a bush as opposed to an overwhelming flame, a bush called Sneh, as opposed to an overwhelming flame on Sinai, same etymology, that I can't listen to. I have to, Tzimtzum, I have to be digestible. And maybe God's body, what Isaiah saw was God just being digestible to Isaiah, as opposed to that's the essence of God. Okay, good, this is good. Rambam loves you guys. Okay, yeah.
Is it possible that talking about God's body was the only way that people could talk about God?
Maybe talking about God's body was the only way that people could talk about God, and therefore it's sort of a version of this, which is, I can't really talk about God, I mean, again, talking to my son, I can't talk about God as an invisible force, F-RCE, we're in a Reconstructionist synagogue, but instead I have to think about the way in which this is how I relate, you know, I know you, you're a body, and we can talk to each other, and that's what I'm going to derive all my communication metaphors
and
from.
And talking about the functions of the body got them into trouble that they didn't want to deal with, so they just stopped there.
Okay, right, you had me up until the other things that the body does, and now I'm out. Let's go back to it. I'd rather talk to the three-year-old about invisible force than I would about God's bodily functions. Okay, yeah.
I think everything that I was wanting to say has sort of been said now, but like, I was just imagining a layer, and I think the lady in the back was sort of saying what I wanted to say, which was, here's this layer of how far our humanness can imagine or sense extreme holiness. And so the layer of the king is like, that's as far, that's as high as we got in our, you know, physical life, is kingship. But then beyond that is the presence. And I wonder if what, you know, what we sense is presence, but what we see is only what we've already seen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good, right. This is a version of what you're saying. I can relate to a metaphor of a king. The king is the most holy, most powerful, most removed person I can think of, and so I'm going to sort of jump off from there as opposed to actually extrapolating forward from God's actual being, whatever that is, which is impossible to write about or talk about.
Yeah.
Good. But by the way, this all sounds great to me. Like, I'm still that Jew that I was yesterday, right, that lives in this. But what I'm trying to do is sort of rip open another possibility that may be hard to digest. So that and we may have to just go back to stage one and say, you know what, this didn't work. But I think it might. That's why I'm trying it. I think it might. As strange and weird and impossible to think about as it is, I'm not saying it will, but I think there's a more than 0% chance that it might. All right, I want to just move on for a second here. I think you'll have the same kinds of questions once we get through section two, which is Chazal. But now we want to get to Chazal, which is also trying to think about a world in which God's presence is able to be related to. And I just want to bring some other examples of how Chazal, that is to say, the sages up through the Talmud, are basically comfortable with describing God as having a body. Okay? Now, helpful framing for this is in a wonderful book called The Body of Faith by Michael Wishergrad, who writes on page 85, that the rabbi, and we're going to have occasion to quote him later on towards the end, the rabbis were not philosophers. I'm reading this to you, it's not in the source sheet. The rabbis were not philosophers and were not particularly upset by the anthropomorphism of the Bible. The rabbis were not philosophers. Philosophers are upset by anthropomorphism,
But the rabbis were not philosophers in that sort of definition of philosophy. The rabbis were not philosophers and were not particularly upset by the anthropomorphism of the Bible. Now, here also, like in the case of the Bible, you could run through many, many examples in Chazal in which God is described as having a body. And we have two choices. One choice is to say, those are all metaphors, or to say, they are just reading the Bible like they do and bringing that image forward. So let's just see a couple of them. Let's see. Look on page 4 on the bottom. Yeah, we'll do page 4 and page 5. Okay. This is an amazing text that has come back into vogue mainly because of its relationship to prayer, but let's just look at it from our lens here. Rabbi Yishmael, son of Elisha, said, Pamachat, he was a Kohen Gadol, Pamachat, the high priest, Pamachat, Nichnasti Laktir Ketorat Lifnei V'Lifnim. One time I, the high priest, entered to do the Ketoret, the incense, in the most inner parts of the temple. Viraiti, Akatriel Yah, Adonai Tzvot. I saw Akatriel Yah, Lord of Hosts. Now, you could say, he saw Akatriel Yah, Adonai Tzvot. That's not the same as Adonai Tzvot. Maybe it's an angel, right? Or maybe it's what he saw. What's the root of Akatriel? The Keter. Maybe he just saw the crown, but there was no body. But he seemed to see, if you're just reading it straight up, seemed to see God. Again, you can wipe that away. You can say, no, it didn't see God. It was an angel. But also you could easily read this as saw God sitting on the high and lofty throne. And then they have a dialogue, which is also kind of amazing. And this sort of moves to the question that I want to explore, which is, if I think of God having a personhood or a body or personality, does it help my relationship? So it's not just I saw God and I died, because you can't see God, but rather I saw God and we had the following conversation, which went like this. God said to me, Yishmael b'ni barcheini, Ishmael, my son, give me a blessing. And then I said, how can I give you a blessing? I'm a person. You're a God. How can I say Baruch Atah Adonai? No, that's not what he said. He said he was ready with a prayer. That's why, you know, any rabbis in the room, you got to be ready to spontaneously pray, okay? You never know when you're going to be asked to do this. He said to me, Ishmael, my son, bless me. I said to him, Yihi ratzon milfanecha, let it be the will before you or before your face, that your mercy subdues your rage and your mercy waves over your attributes, midot, and that you act with your children with the attribute of mercy, you can see a theme here, and bring them into the confines of the law. I would maybe translate that differently. B'tikanes lahem lifnim mishurat hadin. I would say, act beyond the letter of the law with the law might say that you should be a little bit harsher towards them, but why don't you go beyond the letter of the law? And you know what happened? V'na'ana li b'rosho. His head nodded at me. That's what this says in the Talmud on page 7, okay? So this is, now again, you could say, I don't buy it, I don't like it, doesn't happen, made up, LSD, whatever, but this is what is reported as an event that happens in Chazal. And they don't say, but how could Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha have seen the presence of God? Or how could he have blessed God? No, they're just reporting this as something that happened. John.
Well, I don't know what the editor of the Talmud was thinking, but the way that I would read it is to say that the last line, thus we learn that even the blessing of an ordinary person you should not consider unserious, is the whole point. And there was a story structured to like
right, because the only... Okay, so John is saying that we started with the end in mind, which is never take lightly a blessing from someone who's lesser than you.
That's a big thing.
That's a big principle. But the only way that I could illustrate it was when I had Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha see God and have God nod God's head back at him.
Not the only way, but a way that was culturally consistent, that spoke to the text that I had read.
Right.
And that spoke in the language, like some people, you know, I don't want to make light of it, but, you know, there are people who in our world who have less serious people than these people who are always speaking in metaphors, you know? You talk to people who talk, everything's a baseball. I used to work in an environment where everything was a sports metaphor. It was a sports metaphor because they thought that doing business was the same as doing sports.
Right.
And they didn't.
Right.
But that was the language that everybody spoke.
Okay, good. So if this is, if they're speaking always in a language of metaphor, then this is another one of the metaphors they have up their sleeve. All I'm trying to... You don't have to take it home. You don't have to take it home with you. You can live in the world of metaphor forever. But what I'm trying to say is, it seems to me, which I like. I like the world of metaphor. You know me. I'm a metaphor person. But at the end of the day, I'm saying, what if? Let's explore. This is going to end. Whether or not we solve this question, it's going to end at 11:30. For the next 45 minutes, let's live in a world in which we actually imagine that they saw God. I could just give you one other. You don't have to stay there. You can go back to it. It's a baseball metaphor. It was all about the end, and I couldn't think of another way to say it. This is the most powerful way to say it. All right, let's just look at number 15, because this one's less known, but also wacky. Unless it's actually helpful. That's what I'm trying to drive to, okay? Shimon the Righteous ministered as a high priest for 40 years. Okay, the high priest, they had a better shot of seeing God. In his final year, he said to the people, "This year I shall die." They asked him, "How do you know this?" He replied, "Each year when I entered the Holy of Holies, there was an old man wrapped in white garments." By the way, we tried this with our older kids. But by the third kid, you give up. With the first kids, we're like, I think my parents tried this with me. You don't say it. You ask people about what their conception of God is, and they say, classic conception, my old, outdated, silly conception of God when I was a kid was... old man with a white beard sitting in a chair in the sky. Okay? We didn't say that to our kids. We didn't say, you know, God is an old man with a white beard who sits in a chair in the sky. They came up with that themselves. Okay? It's floating around out there in the preschool world. Okay? Preschoolers are talking about this stuff. All right? Now again, maybe the kids have something. Okay? Now this is... Shimon, he's been there for 40 years. He's not a preschooler, all right? What happened? Every year, he went to the Holy of Holies, and there was an old man wrapped in white garments who entered together with me and left with me. This year, however, he entered with me, but he didn't leave with me. Rabbi Abao was asked, "Isn't it written, no man shall be in the tent of meeting when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out?" That is to say, who's this other guy who's walking in with me in the Holy of Holies? I thought I'm the only person supposed to go in. Who's my plus one? And this refers even to angels. It's not that an angel, Akatriel Yah, can walk in with me. It's not Michael, it's not Gabriel. To which Rabbi Abao replied, "I must tell you that Shimon the Righteous was referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which almost always in Chazal means God. Trust me on that one, okay? I don't have to go back to first principles on this. So what is Rabbi Abao? Rabbi Abao, who's living long after Shimon HaTzadik, way, way after, okay? And he's saying, oh, you know what this is? He was accompanied by God. Now, maybe it's God took the form of an old man because that's what Shimon HaTzadik could handle, okay? This is, again, Ben Sommer would say, yeah, that is the way this works out. God can manifest not in God's entirety, in the bodies of local instantiations. But also, he said, it was God. Like, that's it. You know what I'm saying? God had a body and was an old man who was wrapped in white garments. Okay? Now, there's a lot of these that I'm bringing here. Okay? You can run through them. You can take this home. The whole packet you can take home. It's for you. Let's just do one more, because I see I haven't convinced you all. All right? Number 17 on page 6. This is on the Revelation. Davar Acher. Amru, the people say, Ritzonenu lirot et malkenu. Lo domesh shomea liroeh. We want to see our king. Someone who hears is not the same as someone who sees. Seeing is not the same as hearing. That is to say, this is the opposite of the Midrash that we're taught, which is,
oh, God spoke and we all died because we couldn't handle God's voice. Not that they said, you know, the voice isn't bad, but I'd rather see. That's what this midrash is saying, right? We don't want to just hear. We want to see. So, Amar Leih HaMakom, Tein Lahem Ma Shebikshu. Give them what they asked for. Okay? Ki Bayom HaShlishi Yered Adonai Leinei Kol Ha'am Al Har Sinai. Because, quoting from Exodus, in the Torah, it says, on the third day, God will go down Leinei Kol Ha'am, in front of the eyes of all the people, Al Har Sinai. Not you will hear God, but you will see God. Okay, so in Exodus 19, they're getting ready to see God because they wanted to see God because God is seeable. And in this midrash, God says, sure, let's do it. Okay? Seeing is not the same as hearing. Shira.
I guess this is kind of related to that. But I definitely think it's interesting, and I also don't really know what to make of it, that when it describes people seeing God, that experience like stops at seeing. When I think that when you experience bodies, it's also something that you can like touch or smell.
Okay, good. Right. Maybe what she was pointing out is in these examples, it stops at seeing, but the other bodily senses that you interact with other bodies that you are familiar with involve other things like touch and smell and, you know, other ways of relating. Which is a good point. Now again, you could say, well, that's because this was a different order of body. Or you could say, this is what they wanted to write. They wanted to write about the seeing sense here. But maybe, this is what I'm trying to play with, maybe the next step is, well, what would it be like to have that smell, the ketoret, or the touch, or whatever, right? Yeah?
Yeah, because I guess when I think of, like, if I were to say I want to, like, be close to something or more intimate with it, seeing would not be what I would be thinking.
Being close to is a more of a touch. Or
I think a lot of smell in general.
Smell, right, a very strong sense, right? What does God smell? It? God has a body. Does God's body smell? Yeah, Sam.
But you don't touch it.
Okay, maybe it's not possible to touch. There's some distance.
Because
you don't touch a king.
It's not proper.
It's not proper. Right. There's obviously, by the way, they're very clear that there are major boundaries here. Major boundaries. This is not just reception room. You know, you got a VIP pass. The whole point of the VIP pass is to shake Bono's hand. Okay? But this is not what's happening here. Yeah.
Also to play off that idea, the one sense they choose is the one that's often the easiest to trick.
The one sense that they choose is the one that's easiest to trick, which is like, yeah. I mean, think of Isaac. We're all descended from a guy who couldn't really tell the difference between Esav and Yaakov. And that's, maybe we thought we saw something that we didn't. Is that what you're saying? Right. Which also could work out, but even there, I would say, the possibility of seeing something. If I said to you, you know what, I was getting a coffee at Bulun Shri, and I ran into God. You would say, no, that wasn't God. You would say, you're crazy, come with me. Because you would say, God is not seeable. As opposed to, no. You just had you thought that was God, but in other words, they're not saying, nobody's objecting and saying, no, he couldn't see God. They were just saying, no, an angel's not allowed in that room. So then they derived that it must be God, which allows for the possibility that somewhere doesn't have that missight. So I'm not saying that people didn't have a false vision, but the false vision is predicated on the possibility of having a real vision. Yeah.
I just a little bit of it. I'm wondering, what are we thinking when we pray? What's the receiving vehicle?
Yeah. What are we thinking when we pray? What's the receiving vehicle? If God has a body, if all this stuff is supposed to help us, then does prayer look different?
Well, no, I'm actually...
Shomea tefila.
Right.
Who hears prayer, but not in like a invisible force hearing, but in an actual ear hearing way, like this thing. So does that open up a possibility of prayer, or is it just like, that's too weird for me? I can't go down that path, okay? So I want to move there, which is section 4. But yeah, Sarah.
I just want to point out that I think, at least in the biblical sources, but I think probably also in most of the big ones, you almost never see God's body all at once. Right? You see, like, if you see God's body, you see parts of God's body.
Good.
I don't know whether that pushes us in the metaphorical direction or...
Okay. Sarah's pointing out that in the biblical sources and in the Chazal ones here, you don't see all of God all at once. You don't see the entirety of God's body. Now, let's just move to the next level, which is where this starts to break down, Okay? And where our metaphor... So maybe to do that, let's just see... Well, hold on. If God has a body, then I should be able to really get down and dirty with what the body is. So take a look at page 9. This is about as far as we're going to go, okay, in terms of the God-body thing. This is a book called Shi'ur Koma, which was the measurement of God's stature, but really the measurement of God's body, okay? This is a text that's known to the medievals, that's known to, as we'll see, it's known to the Rambam, and earlier authorities. And it's a long text. I didn't bring you the entire thing. I just brought you the introduction. I hope you'll get the point. Okay? So page 9, source number 24. Rabbi Akiva said, I testify that Metatron, the great Lord, said to me. Okay, Metatron, an angel. I'm totally cool with angels, by the way. Angels, no problem, look like people. Okay? An angel. Metatron, the greatest angel, said, I bear this testimony on behalf of the Lord, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Elohim of Israel, the living and enduring El, our Lord, our Master. Okay, this is his height. From the seat of glory and up is 118, 10,000 parsangs. You know how big that is?
No.
Super big. It's like this, but bigger, okay? Really big. From his seat of glory down is 118, 10,000 parsangs. Seat of glory. I could deal with that. It's a really big chair. Let's keep going. His total height is 236 10,000 parsangs. How big is God's body? So much bigger than that chair. So much bigger, okay? From his right arm to his left arm is 77 10,000 parsangs. From his right eye to his left eye is 30 10,000 parsangs. The skull on his head, 3 1/3 10,000 parsangs. You get the point? Okay? We're going to describe God's body in measurement. Now, this was not like an exercise in strange math. This was a mystical text that was meant to be used to connect deeper to God. Now, you might say, that doesn't work for me. But it worked for somebody because it was a text that was well known. This was not a text that they found on the floor that some guy was doodling when he wasn't paying attention in Maimonides' rationalism class, but it was actually a real text that real Jewish mystics were engaging with. This is when you take it as far as you want to go. Ariel said, well, what? Well, now we have to start asking questions about his body. So here they're answering questions. What's that?
Why is the body so much bigger than the
chair? Why is the body so much bigger than the chair? It's to impress you. I mean, you thought the chair, I started off with the chair, you're like, I can't even imagine a chair that big. Yeah.
But might not the hyperbole be there to say, listen, this is so exaggerated, it's foolish.
Yeah. 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 Right. Maybe this is all to show us how silly this whole endeavor is. Oh, you think God has a body? Well, great. Then let's start talking about that body. Well, if you think God has a body, you're going to have to buy into all this kind of approach because that's where it's going to lead you. You could go down that path. Or you could say that it wasn't written ironically. Because they did, it's like much longer than this little paragraph. So like they spent a long time really drawing out the irony of it. If that's what they're, but I can't rule it out. Again, we can all go back to our safe place of where we were at 10:15, where God doesn't have a body, this is all metaphor, and this doesn't show up. Okay, Adina.
I think that another approach, in contrast to the one that was just put forward, is that if God has a body, then we're interacting with God on the personal level of seeing God as one of us and as being like ourselves. But this wants to redistance God by making God so magnanimous, huge, and enormous that we can't possibly conceive of a body in those terms.
Good. Okay, so now you're saying as well, if the goal is to connect to God, this one actually distances us from God because it's not really, I can't even imagine anybody of that size, and so I can't imagine like having a conversation, getting back to prayer. I can't even imagine, this doesn't help me with my conversation approach to God, and therefore it's undoing the possibility. Maybe it was sort of meant to distance God. Okay, yes, that is a problem. Eric, I'm waiting.
Good. If you're willing to entertain the fact of God having a body, which you are,
I am, but I'm just bringing you an overwhelming sense of evidence
here.
Tell me
about God's gender.
Yeah, right. This is what Ariel was asking. What's God's gender?
And if you can't imagine, if you can't take a position on that, then how can you imagine God's body?
Good. So now, so you have to go down two pathways here, maybe, which is to say, God has a body. Bodies are bodies that we know, and there's X, Y, and XX. And so you have to just sort of like choose and go down that path. And maybe we have to. By the way, these guys probably weren't so afraid of that path. And I have a guess of which way they're going to go. Yeah.
I'm not quite understanding why it's so surprising or weird to think of God having a body, because in Rishit, the Torah tells us that God made us in his likeness.
Yeah, good, right.
We have bodies.
Right.
Our body is not a metaphor.
Here comes somebody who says, wait a minute, God made us in his likeness. And, well, yeah, whew.
I have a body.
I have a body,
but I can't see all of your body.
True. Can't see all my body.
Yeah, I can see your back.
True.
I can't see the bottom of your feet. If you're standing on your hands, I can see the top of your feet, but then I can't see your hands. There's always some part of even a real non-mental body that we can't see.
Okay, good. So this is where I want to go, which is, hold on. You're saying this isn't news. It says it right in Bereishit. God forms us after his likeness. This is my likeness, so therefore, just working backwards, God also must have this likeness. It's not crazy. And that likeness also, by the way, the original Adam was, you know, sort of, this is where you don't have to make that choice that Eric's trying to make us do. The original Adam seems to be not clear about like a sex distinguishing features. Okay, so we have to ask the question, at what point did we all get into the warm bath of anthropomorphism is bad? So I just want to explore that with you for one last moment before we dive into the work we need to do. So here we go. And again, I'm quoting again from Michael Wishegrad, who, you don't have this in your packet, but it's on 85 in his book, The Body of Faith. He said, this relates to what you're saying, the real God whom Adam feared and loved fades to be replaced by a philosophical principle. The real estrangement between God and man has begun when the philosophic critique of anthropomorphism comes into its own. The reality of God recedes. Okay, so when the philosophers get hold of the concept of God, then the reality and the experience of God recedes, says Wishegrad, and now our relationship has been reduced. So I just want to look at where that happens, and it's fascinating, okay? We know the Rambam is lurking here. Okay, and just turn back to page 7. The Rambam says there are 5 kinds of heretics. See, check all that apply, okay? One who says there is no God and no ruler of the world. That's one. One who's, I'm in text 21 on page 7. One who says that there is a ruler of the world, but there are two or more. Polytheists. Number 3. One who says that there is one master, but he has a body and image. Aval shehu guf ubal tmuna. He is a body and is a picture, an image, okay? That is one of the top 3 heretical approaches. Now, what's amazing about the Rambam is the Rambam didn't always think this way. But the Rambam wants us to think that the Rambam always thought this way because he ended up becoming the Rambam. So let's just check out how this happens. So the Rambam writes the commentary on the Mishnah, which you can see on page 8. He writes that in his youth. He's like in his 20s. He's millennial Rambam, okay? He doesn't have a job. He's like on the run. And he decides to write an entire comprehensive commentary on the Mishnah. I'm not saying the millennials here didn't do that. I'm just saying he did. Okay, so the 7th principle, he's on Sanhedrin 10.1. Commentary on Mishnah Sanhedrin 10.1, which is all of Israel has a chelech l'olam haba. So he's going to lay out some principles here. So one of the principles he's laying out is the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, peace be upon him, is that we believe that he was the father of all prophets, and there were before and after that there were before him and there rose after him, like Yigdal says. Okay. About this matter, it was stated that he would speak with God, may he be blessed, without an angelic intermediary. Okay. Now then, the Rambam says, if I was going to tell you how this works, I would need many, many proofs, and like I don't have enough pages to do that here as I'm on the run from Spain to Egypt,
So, but while he's telling you what he would have to do, he says to you, look in the bold part, and the circle would need to be widened about the things I would need to write about, to the point that we would speak about the forms that the prophets spoke about concerning the Creator and his angels, like Isaiah, and we would speak about Shiur Koma and its concepts. V'itgalgel b'toch ha'dvarim Shiur Koma v'inyano. So he, in the commentary of the Mishnah, says, Shiur Koma, that thing with God's chair and God's body and the distance, the Rambam knows about it. And he says, if you really want to understand how Moshe spoke to God and got prophecy, I'd have to start also writing about these other things. Now, what's amazing is the Rambam stuff was published during his lifetime, so he had an opportunity to edit it. So in the first edition of the commentary of the Mishnah, this is here. In the second edition of the commentary of the Mishnah, this is scratched out. And the editor who published it in the 20th century said, the scratch out on this line was more intense than any other scratch out. Okay? The Rambam goes back on the idea that Shiur Koma is part of the canon. And if you turn back to page 7, he's asked the following question in one of his tshuvas. They ask him, teach us your honor. That's the Rambam. What is it appropriate to answer one who asks a question about Shiur Koma? Is it like the words of the one who said that it was a Karaite work? Boo, Karaites. And he transmitted this in the name of your honor, the Rambam. Oh, this Karaite said that the Rambam says that Shiur Koma is a holy book. Is that correct? Or is it a deep secret of the sages that has within it deep subjects, both natural and supernatural? Like Rabbeinu Chai, Rav Chai said in one of the notebooks on questions on Chagiga, which has been published. Tell us what you think. Answer. I never thought that this is one of the books of the sages, and God forbid that it should be one of those. This is not a real book. It is nothing more than a book of one of the Greek interpreters, boo, and nothing else. And the end of it is that this book should be erased to excise the memory of its subjects is a great mitzvah. If you find Shiur Koma, rip it up. The name of other gods you should not mention, and it's written about it. This one is one who has a measure, a koma, a body. This is other gods without doubt. If you read this book, it's idolatry. Okay? Now the Rambam has, it turns out, an outsized influence on our conception of God. Okay? And Yigdal and other creations based on the Rambam's principles give us the world that we live in which Ein lo dimut haguf, yein lo guf. He doesn't have a form of a body, doesn't have a body. Shiur Koma, not Jewish. I don't like it. It's not Jewish. Okay? There is no body of God. All that stuff that you thought you saw in the Torah and Chazal, it's a metaphor. Right? Spends a lot of time in the Guide of the Perplexed telling you how it's a metaphor. We can live there. Metaphors are good. Baseball works at Goldman. It helps. Okay? But just note that it is a turn. It's a turn. And even the Rambam is living in a world where Shiur Koma is standard, and he has to go and attack it directly in order to live in the world he wants to live in, where all this is metaphor and philosophic principles. That's when Visegrad said, the real God, whom Adam feared and loved, the God I can have a relationship with, becomes a principle. And it's much harder to love a principle. You can love principles in theory, you can be excited about a principle, but to have a relationship with you, I kind of need you to have an eye and some physical feedback with me. You've been waiting.
Sorry, you describe the feeling of God having a body as, kind of warm space and almost intellectually lazy, but at least in Chazal, there are an equivalent amount of statements that God doesn't have a body in Avodah Zarah and that whole concept, such that the metaphor is an evolved way for the rabbis to ask us to synthesize clear statements that he has a body, clear statements that he doesn't have a body. So for every source you cite that, in Chazal at least, that describes him having a body, there's an equal source in Avodah Zarah says, doesn't have a body, and this is Avodah Zarah, this is wrong. So how do you mesh it together? That's the metaphor.
Okay, so you're suggesting, well, maybe it's more nuanced, more complicated when it gets to Chazal. Perhaps God's the pro-God body side and the anti-God body side are all alive there, and they're sort of duking it out, and the Rambam goes way over to one side, but part of our project would be to synthesize these sources. Okay, that's one way to go, by the way. You can take that path. What I want to end our time with here is the fourth section, which is, could it help us to go down the path of God has a body, now what? Okay? Again, you don't have to leave with this. But that's what I want to just try in our last few minutes together. Okay? So, please.
So, I keep thinking about
bodies, trying to get my mind around having a body, him having a body, and bodies die.
Bodies die. Okay, right. So
old men die.
Old men die. They age. By the way, they change. Right?
Old people die.
Old people.
Right. So at what point does the body metaphor, the body concept, the body image, the body depart from you? Because we do know that God is not human.
It's not a human
right?
body. It's a likeness of the body. It does not have to be male. It doesn't have to be female. It doesn't have to be, I mean, you're jumping into your own body.
Okay, but you are saying it is a challenge that needs to be at least worked. You have to say God's body is not exact, doesn't work exactly the same as my body, because I know my body slows down. Although apparently God's body ages.
Does the word for body come up in other ways to describe form rather than just body, or is goof the word that
goof?
Happens all these times?
Yeah, well, you saw the biblical text doesn't necessarily use the word goof, but it's the experience of God. Okay, we can go somewhere in the middle of this spectrum. I want to try out these sources here, these last sources, okay? Now, I want to, what I want to posit, the possibility is, if I think of God having a body, I might go farther in my own relationship with God. I might not. Then we can chuck it out and go back to the Rambam, okay? Or any of the in-between places that you're trying to take us to. But let's see, might it work? So I want to try it with two texts. One is on 13. Okay, the bottom of 13, text 28. Oh, I have to bring so many texts just to get this done. Really, it's like overkill here. Okay. Ani Betzedek, quoting from Tehillim Yud Zayin, Psalm 17. Ani Betzedek achazeh panecha. I, Betzedek, through righteousness, will... Where's my chazon people? What does that mean? Achazeh. See, vision. I will envision your face. I, in righteousness, will envision your face. There it is, hanging out in Psalm 17. What does it mean? Okay. Now again, whether God has a face or God doesn't have a face, I want to try out what this would mean if we took it literally. Rabbi Dosai Bar Yonai said, come see how God is not like flesh and blood. Flesh and blood. If you bring a gift to the king, it's in doubt whether he will receive it or not. And even if he receives it, it's in doubt whether you will see the face of the king or not. And even if you see the face of the king, it's in doubt whether or not he will do your will, right? You bring a gift to the king. Another word for a gift is a bribe, okay? I want the king to do something that I want. I need to close this zoning deal. Have a monarchy, okay? Have a gift. You remember the monarchy, right? From a few years ago? Okay. That was when Hanukkah and the turkey, the menorah. Come on. How can we be expected to remember our own sources when we can't remember the menorah, which was only... I mean, Hanukkah and Thanksgiving are not going to fall together for another 15 million years. All right, anyways. I'm going to bring a gift to the king. I was just thinking about that because that's what they gave Obama. It was like a gift. Menorah. He still has it. And I'm going to... I'm not even sure if he's going to take the gift. Okay? So the whole thing is, if I give you a gift, you're going to do what I want. I'm not sure he's going to take the gift. I'm not sure that I get to see the king. Maybe just a local bodyguard takes it. And I'm not sure that even if you take the gift, you're going to do what I want you to do. But God is not so. A person gives, Adam notain pruta la'ani, a person gives a coin to a poor person. Zocheu mikabel pnei shechina. He merits to see the face of the presence, of the Shekhinah. Shekhinah, it's the 10th sphere. Okay, fine. It's the presence of God. Just work with me for a second here, okay? Zocheh u'mikabel p'nei Shekhinah. He sees the presence, the face of the presence. Proof text, ani b'tzedek achazeh panecha. How is the verse being read? Explain the verse to me. Ani b'tzedek achazeh panecha. How's it work?
I,
through an act of giving tzedakah, see your face. When did I see God's face? In the poor person. The poor person has the face of God. That's what this text says. It doesn't make sense unless you read it that way. Ani b'tzedek, it doesn't say, ani b'tzedek achazeh p'nei ha'ani. It says, ani b'tzedek achazeh panecha. When I give tzedakah,
I see the face of the poor person. Who is your face? Now, if God has a face, imagine if you walk, Shai says this all the time. Imagine if you walked around and the people who are asking for money, who are lying in the street, you see them and you see God's face. Not a metaphor of God's face, not an ideal, not a capable of love, but the actual face of God is lying there in the street and asking you for money.
But you have to see the face.
You have to see the face.
If you look away.
If you look away, it doesn't work. That's right. The only way, you want to encounter God's face, give a poor person who is facing you a coin. That's how it works, right? Now, again, I think we could all like be in favor of tzedakah. I don't have to convince you about the power and the goodness of tzedakah. But would you relate to the mitzvah of tzedakah differently if God had a face and you saw that face on the face of the poor person? That's what I'm trying to explore. Would it help us? Would I relate to God differently if I encountered that poor person in that moment as literally a copy of the divine face? Maybe. I don't know. Okay. I want to do one last text here. This is one of my most favorite texts, which if you get into the metaphor or perhaps the image that they're willing to go with, I think it can have some relationship possibilities that are useful. Okay? Now, it's a little bit long, but it's worth reading. It's the bottom of page 11 from Devarim Rabbah. There are different versions of this midrash. I'm going to read the one from Devarim Rabbah. I made you grow like grass of the field. This is a verse from Ezekiel. How so? Now, I'm going to explain this verse. And it says the midrash, and it's in the time when Bnei Israel were enslaved in Egypt. When Pharaoh decreed that all newborn boys would be cast into the sea, what did the women do? When a Jewish woman felt contractions beginning, she would go out to give birth in a field, right? Now, those are running away from the decree of Pharaoh. So they go out to the field to give birth because there they might be able to hide the child. Once she's given birth, she would look up and say, you said, be fruitful and multiply. I've done my part. Now you do yours. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
What would the Egyptians do? When the Egyptians saw the Jewish women going out to the field, they caught on to this scheme to give birth there. They would watch them from a distance. Once the Jewish women had given birth and returned to the city, the Egyptians would pick up rocks and go to kill the babies. But the infants would be swallowed up in the field and would reappear far away. This is like the original whack-a-mole game, okay? Only to be swallowed up again and appear again elsewhere, again and again, until the Egyptians got tired and went away. That's an amazing image, okay? Now, just hold on to there because, okay, we've escaped the Egyptians who are trying to kill the babies, but if you've ever been a baby, and I'm pretty sure that we all have, then you'll remember that it's very hard to survive by yourself, even if someone's not trying to hit you on the head with a rock. So that's where we are. How did the children live in the fields? Rabbi Levi said, the Holy Blessed One would assign two angels to each one to wash her and one to clothe her. And he nursed and anointed them. As it said, he nursed you with honey from the rock. And I washed you with water and clothed you with garments. Okay, how are they surviving? You got your angels. Angels, totally on board with angels. Angels helping us? Got it. An angel suckles me? I'm there. An angel clothes me? Good. Rabbi Chiya the Great said, it wasn't the angels who did that. Rather, the Holy Blessed, Kodesh Baruch Hu Be'atzmo, said it. As it says, I washed you, not angels. Had it said, I caused you to be washed, I would have said that perhaps it was an angel. But since it says, I washed you and not an angel, may the name of the Holy Blessed One be blessed, since he himself cared for them. Now let's keep going. The babies grew in the field like grass. And after they grew, they returned to their homes. This is what Yechezkel said when he said, you grew like grass in the field. How did they know? You remember babies, right? Okay, they're alive. No one's trying to kill them. They've been clothed and they've been fed. Now it's time for them to find their mother. You saw the movie, right? With the guy and the train and the Indian, and it was crazy and it took him 5 years to find his mother. You're a baby. You don't have Google Earth. How are you going to find your parent? What's going to work? Okay. The Holy Blessed One accompanied them. How did they know which family was theirs? The Holy Blessed One accompanied them, pointed each and every one to his parents' home, and said, call your father and your mother by this name. In other words, oh, you're a baby? How do I know I'm... come on, prove it. David Letterman. No, I'm actually yours, because your name is whatever your name is, okay? The children would say to their mothers, don't you remember when you gave birth to me? On this day, that field, five months or years ago, Jason translated this. And in other words, they would say, my birthday is September 30th, 1973. And they're like, how'd you know that? She said, who raised you? And he would say, Bachur Echad, a special, handsome young man. She'ein Kayotsebo. Nobody is like him anywhere. He brought me here. And he's right outside. She would say to him, come and show him to me. And they would go outside and search all the alleyways and everywhere, but they couldn't find him. When they came to the sea, when they left Egypt, when the sea split, they saw him. And they pointed him out to their mothers with their fingers. And they said, Ze'eli, this is my God. Vianvehu, this is the one who raised me. So the Ish Milchama, the man of war that's seen at the splitting of the sea, is not just a man of war, it's not just that Bachur who's a soldier, but he's actually the Bachur who cares for these babies, raised them, which I would say is sort of a feminine image, and took them home and brought them to their parents. Who was that man? I went out to look for him, but he was gone. I couldn't find him anywhere. But then he comes back. So what I love about this text is it's such a relatable image, right? If I said to you, I was raised by a philosophical concept who was omnipotent and omniscient, I'm not going to get all teary. But if you imagine that somebody, an actual person-like figure, took care of me because they loved me, and they needed to feed me and put clothes on me and nevertheless were willing to part with me and bring me to my parents who abandoned me in the field years ago and restored that relationship. And they asked me, who raised you? And I don't say a philosophical concept, but I say, this young, beautiful man raised me who no one else is like. And then they come back and they look for him and they can't find him, because he disappears like people tend to do. But then he comes back at the splitting of the sea. Can that help our own relationship with God? Maybe. I'm stopping here. Beautiful.